Welcome to Working Mom Hour.
Oh, fuck.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Working Mom Hour. I'm Erica.
And I'm Madeline. We're working moms, business partners, and friends with kids at different ages and stages.
We know moms tend to get more done in an hour than the average human, yet are often misunderstood and underappreciated in the workplace.
We are here to shine a light on the working mom experience to help ourselves and others step into and advocate for the superpower.
We are not experts.
We're two women who have been there and are still there, kids, clients, and all.
Join us as we cultivate more joy in working motherhood at the corner of calm and chaos.
Welcome to Working Mom Hour. Today, we are joined by Dr. Christine Gloria to help wrap our heads around all things AI. Christine is a recovering academic with a PhD in cognitive science, a budding social impact entrepreneur, and a dedicated steward of technology for good. She is currently the head of data for Blue Fever, a social wellness app for teens who are on a mental health journey. Before that, she was co-founder and chief science officer for Slow Talk, where she brought AI to large organizations to help retain, develop, and understand their people through the platform.
Christine is passionate about issues such as trustworthy AI, empathetic research and innovation, and women in tech. Let's say hello again to Dr. Christine Gloria.
Christine, welcome back to Working Mom Hour.
So excited.
Yeah, we're so excited. You were on our first season and you were talking about all things AI. And lately, all things AI have turned into all things ChatGPT. And that matriculates not just like our work life, but our home life. Mm. And being a fellow working mom, we thought it made sense to bring you back on. So we're happy you're here.
Yes. Excited to geek out with all of you again. It was so fun the first time.
Please. So. This is also polarizing. So I think it'll be interesting conversations.
Okay.
I mean, I think we're probably on the side of fans of ChatGPT and how it can streamline our lives. But let's start by briefly defining AI. How long has it been around and why does it seem to be what everyone's talking about right now?
Yeah, so I think it's interesting because there are lots of different talks about the blossoming and the wintering of AI. It's been around for several decades, at least the pursuit of it has been around in decades. And if you really kind of start going through the theory of AI or the field of AI, you'll see it's informed by lots of different thinking. Philosophy, my background in cognitive science is a big one, computer science, the barest form. It's how can we get a machine to replicate human knowledge, human expression, things like that, where you're trying to match whether the machine can predict better than a human is always kind of like the bars. For example, the most recent markers for these prior to ChatGPT is, can it play better chess than the world's best chess master? Can it play Go better than the best Go players, right? And those have all been blown out of the water.
Meaning it can?
Yes, yeah, that the machine can play better.
And that's
like
the fearful thing. I think that's why people are afraid.
In some ways it's great because it's a milestone that's checked off. But if you think about if there's a problem space that a computer needs to compute in order to beat a human, both Go and chess have really constrained problem spaces. So if you think about a chessboard, the probability of the number of chess moves that a computer has to calculate is actually fairly limited because it's only on what's on that chessboard. Same with Go. Go is a lot much larger set of dimensionality because it has a lot more spaces, but it's still a somewhat finite number of probable moves. I think where it gets more interesting, this is where the general AI and why people find ChatGPT really fascinating is that that problem space is much larger when you're having conversation or if you're having quote unquote a conversation with a system because it has to think of all language probabilities, sentence probabilities and structure, and in context to the conversation you're having. So that, again, they called the dimensionality space is much larger. So that's why it's really intriguing to think, oh, we're really moving towards something that is pushing us more towards a general AI. And again, there's a lot of other things there, like can the AI learn on its own, which in some cases like ChatGPT, you could say it's unsupervised learning. It's based on information. It can make up its own responses without an engineer telling it exactly what it needs to spit out, right? And again, a lot of it, it's a game of probability. If you were to put in a question, like say, how many colors are there in the rainbow? That narrows that probability space really quickly for the computer to figure out, right? Because it's like, okay, no, rainbow, number of colors. So then it can calculate that, give you the best answer as quickly as possible. So when you think about how AI kind of moves in these spaces, those are the techniques that push it to being more complicated, right? Is how much of the problem can it quickly reduce down to an answer?
Interesting. I've been playing with ChatGPT for our business and personal, just trying to wrap my head around it. And I'm finding there is an art to the prompt.
Yes.
Like it can be a great collaborator if you're asking it for what you need in the right ways.
Yeah. I was just at a set of conversations with some people in Singapore where we were talking about ChatGPT and the future of AI and work. And one of the claims is that whether it's going to fully replace humans is a whole different bag. But I think what it does show is that the skill set that you'll need is actually writing prompts, right? Mm-hmm. That will be a position for a lot of people.
It's going to be great for you, Marla. This is right up your alley.
Yeah, I guess.
How well can you write a prompt? Because that's going to be, if your industry or your sector feels that ChatGPT could be useful, it is about the prompt making, right? So that's a specific skill set that one could start to really finesse to be super successful using that technology.
Yeah. I think people forget too, like we have spell check. That we're so easy to use. But when it comes to ChatGPT, we're like, oh my gosh, something could write for me. And then I was thinking the other day, I was like, oh, someone could do the first draft for me. Yes. That is helpful.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So. There's a couple examples I've seen running around. But one, if you remember when the like Microsoft Office suite came out, and then Excel was a part of that. There were whole courses on how to use Excel. How is it given? Like, it just helps us to do our jobs differently and more effectively. Like, accountants didn't lose their jobs. The Excel spreadsheet didn't replace accountants. It just freed accountants up to do less of the manual adding and subtracting and more of the strategy. So I think this conversation in 5-10 years, we're going to look back just like we did with Facebook and all of the new things, the internet. I mean, I can remember when the internet first came. My parents were like, oh, there's a computer lab in your college. You don't need a computer for your dorm room. Like, but I do, guys. I really do.
It's interesting. Yeah, you're probably right. In probably less than 5 years, people are going to be, oh, yeah, this is a tool that's helpful for first drafts. I think what's interesting, particularly about ChatGPT, is how easy it is for someone to, with no background in AI, to feel like they're engaged in something sophisticated like that. Whereas Excel, yes, you do have to do kind of classes, some training, but ChatGPT, you could just play around with. And so that instant burst of distribution helps with that hype cycle of the powerfulness of what ChatGPT could do. I will say we also use it for first drafts for a lot of things. So I can see where that's super efficient.
Can you define what ChatGPT is?
Oh, yeah. So it's a large language model, meaning that it takes in lots of content that scrapes from the internet. So anything that's publicly facing, and is essentially a chatbot that you can interact with that seemingly can provide really, really both wide answers, meaning that it can cover a lot of different topics and questions, but really deep depth too, meaning like it can have a full quote-unquote conversation with you as you drill down into certain questions. But it's essentially a very sophisticated chatbot.
So, and I know we've been focused on ChatGPT, but what are ways working moms can use AI to help with their, you know, busy lives, work-life harmony? I think there is this interpretation that this is new, but I think we've actually probably been using AI, like you mentioned chatbots, we've been using for customer service. Almost everybody across the board has incorporated a chatbot.
Yeah.
Like DoorDash, right? That's AI.
Yeah. In the field, it's called weak AI. So these are AIs that are seemingly not AI. So anything that does prediction models on something that you might want to buy next, the right type of diaper, those things, anything that you interact on Amazon is considered kind of like a weak AI. It's a recommendation system. Driving. Anytime you use your Google Maps, there's a lot of quote-unquote AI in the background there. I think rightfully so, there's this big AI robots idea of them taking over society. But right. there's so much of it that's already integrated. It's, it's that phenomenon, like you don't notice it's creeping up on you kind of thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. yeah. We're the frog in the boiling water. We're already in the pot, guys. We're in the pot.
Yeah, exactly. And so part of it is not just recognizing, okay, there's different types of levels of AI that we interact with almost all the time, constantly to our day to day. And then, yes, there are maybe some more higher level threatening AIs that could potentially be problematic, but hopefully those are things that we're keeping in front of us. I think one of the things I worked on for a while was those non-obvious AI applications. And so one of the ones where it is problematic and people have been really digging into it is your financials, right? Mortgages are based on AI algorithms, hiring AI algorithms. Like all of mm-hmm. these things are problematic. They're used constantly.
Yep.
But I think we're getting better at understanding kind of like the downstream effects of using those types of decision-making systems. And that's to show you, it's there. We're in it. We may not know it's there, but things are constantly being determined by some sort of algorithm on our behalf.
Yeah. We had a situation that happened to us recently where our bank threatened to close our personal and business accounts because of a glitch in an algorithm. And it sent out a letter. And then when we tried to reach out to humans, they're like, oh, sorry, you got the letter and we can't do anything about the letter. Luckily, Joe knew the president of the bank and was like, hey, why is this happening to us? I've been a member of your bank since I was 16 years old. They were like, sorry, it was an AI algorithm that did it. I was like, what if we didn't know the president of the bank? We would be screwed. So there are definitely downsides to how they're using AI.
Yeah, I think finance, healthcare is another big one.
Yeah.
Diagnostics being made on really complicated algorithms that are based on studies or data that are super biased. There's a really great one out there where I think it was kidney or maybe liver was diagnoses were discriminating against the Black community. And it's because they didn't have data that capture the prevalence within that specific community. So it was making judgments based on the majority community at that point. And it's just, these are the things that I think for people on a day-to-day kind of have to know that it's happening and just check. Always check on whether that's makes sense.
Like if you're pinged about something or if like a doctor tells you something, question it, you're saying.
Yeah, okay. always question it. They're likely looking at a set of data points that a algorithm has synthesized on their behalf. And then you just have to say, well, does that make sense? And then have them articulate why it makes sense and see if that is the case. I do think for large hospital systems, it's difficult because you're trying to service a lot of people. And so you try to optimize for getting as many people in, diagnosing them as quickly as possible. And so you kind of always have to advocate for your individual care. And I will say, I think as women, particularly healthcare is one that if you're going into it and are being given a whole lot of things that are via an algorithm, I'd take a beat and really ask your doctor to go drill deep on it.
Yeah. And I have to imagine that when we do get there, when it is like accurately predicting a lot of things, like it's going to be amazing. Mm-hmm. Like we were just talking to a founder of a healthcare company and she was like, we get notified of so many things every day, but not related to our health. We are going to get notified about bills and appointments and things all day, but we're not notified that we're pre-menopause.
Right.
Yeah. We're not getting these health notifications that like one day it seems like we will maybe get there.
Yeah. I will say, you know, cancer research has made tremendous bounds because of these sophisticated algorithms. I'm not saying everything's bad, but for every three-step leap, you think of potentially what's not catching up. So
yeah. So as a tech expert, what advice would you give to, let's say, moms who are looking to upskill and stay relevant in the rapidly evolving tech industry? Like what platform should we become familiar with? What should we be studying? Because I did see a quote recently that basically said AI is not going to replace humans, but if you're a human who doesn't understand AI, you're going to be replaced.
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say stay plugged in terms of what you could read that's accessible in this space without going really deep into like language models and all those things. Pick up Wired once in a while. That's a great resource to understand. Yeah. They write it really comprehensively. Or even if you really want to tiptoe, you could pick up an MIT Technology Review. A lot of the things they write in there is accessible, but a little geekier. So it depends on where you want to go on that direction. In terms of skill building, though, I will say that a lot of the skills that I think will come to the top, even within the tech industry, will be skills that are not automatable. Like coding, machines can code on their own. There are instances of that. So yeah, sure, you can pick up a coding class, but likely that's actually not going to be one of the more needed positions. Communicating what the platform is doing will definitely be one of those skill sets that is a fine art. There's an art in that. I always strive, particularly when I'm hiring, to look at, well, how well can this person communicate that project they just presented or just built? Because I don't care if you're efficient or as accurate as possible, but you can't tell me why it's doing that, or you can't present it in the context of what would drive the business or product. Mm-hmm. It's not useful to me. And so I do think that's a skill that we're already, like most people inherently can work on without having to really dive into a program. For those who do want to make like a bigger shift, let's say you want to get into the data science portion of it, or if you really want to do machine learning, like really getting the tech, YouTube has some incredible, incredible videos. I will say that if I get stuck, I YouTube it. And there are lots of things there where you can, people just show you exactly what you can experiment with.
Okay. So what if I don't want to dive in?
Yeah. Yeah.
But I do want to know about how to protect my kids on their devices, what their devices are absorbing. Right. I'm not really interested in the topic outside of my everyday tech utilization and like understanding what my kids are learning and things like that.
Yeah, there's actually, particularly with young families, there are some really good groups out there that are giving better frameworks for understanding media usage, media consumption. I would look to those groups. One of the best ones is actually Sesame Street Workshop. They have a really great focus on the digital space and how youth should be engaging.
Cool.
And so like that's a great one. We know that's been around for a while, but they have a digital arm where they really just kind of focus. So I will say there's groups like that. There's the National Association of Media Educators, and that is also very good. They give lots of different toolkits and frameworks for people to look at. Common Sense Media. So there are organizations that spend lots of time trying to communicate that level of information, particularly for families.
I've been using Common Sense Media ever since you recommended it.
Oh, good. Yeah.
A year or two ago to look up specifically movies. Yeah. I can look up like an age group and it'll give me movies and the various ratings from like a Common Sense Media standpoint.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Yeah. I love working with them and their products, because their products are geared towards parents or educators or people who, yes, have to be supports or guides for young people as they kind of like figure out what to do. So I would look at those. What I would not look at, if that's helpful.
Yes.
Is I would not look at individual influencers in this space. Mm. I think that how your family consumes media or uses media or technology is obviously a family choice. You do what you need to do for your family. And I think when you have like individuals coming on into that, it's usually in the context of their own needs as a family. Maybe that aligns very closely to yours, but I like looking at larger organizations who do more research on kind of like a general, on an average, what would be best for certain families. And then you can kind of pick from there.
Okay. That makes sense. And as the technology increases in our lives, I know there are concerns about its impact on mental health and well-being. We all experience it. We see it and try to mitigate it in our kids. How can we mitigate the potential negative effects? I mean, I think a lot about my kids, but I also think it's important to have the conversation around ourselves, because that trickles down.
Totally. Like, do you remember when, was it Facebook that went down and then Twitter, like the metaverse went down? And you knew everybody was out. Like, you weren't missing anything. There was nothing to catch up on. It felt like a vacation for a minute.
Freedom.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Like, everybody was in the same boat and everybody was taking a walk outside because they couldn't be on social. So,
Sure. Yeah.
I set time limits on my social apps now. Like, I only get like 10 minutes of TikTok, Instagram per day.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, I just can't do it anymore. It's draining.
It is draining. I have two main paths that I usually think about on this. One is education. Know that there are mental health implications, both good and bad. I think that, again, the jury is out if it leans one way heavier or another, at least from a scientific standpoint. But there are repercussions, good or bad. And so just kind of understand that. Naming that, knowing that is really important. I think some people tend to fall in there in one camp or the other, but we actually don't know if it's all positive, all negative, right? I think it's a mixture. The other is, yeah, I think the one thing that is consistent is that taking a break is a must. Moving away from this concentration of information being thrown at you, mm-hmm. regardless if it's social media, if it's checking CNN every 2 seconds, if it's your TV, if it's your phone, you just got to give your brain a break. Mm-hmm. And so being consistent about that is probably the best way to help mitigate. This is true for adults. It's true for youth, but there's also a developmental aspect on the youth end that I think is worth also understanding, is that because their brains are developing, that break might need to be a bigger break, might need to be a more frequent break. Also because they're not only are they physiologically developing, emotionally and mentally, they are in different stages. And so when you think about the information, again, coming in at high volumes and at speed for someone who is still developing all three of those, that's a very different set of levels that you need to account for to help with that mitigation.
Do you think all of this talk of the government stepping in around TikTok and making the internet age higher, is all of that just talk, or do you think that's going to come to fruition? Because I really do think this is a health issue.
This is the thing, kind of like the cat is out of the bag. I cannot foresee the government saying we're going to raise access age to 15 even, then coming in and taking all devices away from, you know, even my child who's 7 has one, right? I don't think that is practical or doable. I do think there will be the pressures put upon the companies to better police those things. It's fashioned after something that's coming out of the UK, which not surprisingly, the EU is driving a lot of the pressures here on changing regulatory standards on anything internet, anything technology related. But there's one in particular that's the design practices for building apps targeted at children, anyone under 18. These are those like little regulatory pushes that are going to happen. This is actually already enacted in California. States like New Mexico, Maryland, Massachusetts are all looking to put these on the books, because what it does is it sets a level for companies to have to be held either accountable or they will be liable for designing and deploying technology targeted at young people that do not take into account explicitly mental health impacts.
What's an example? Is it like the amount of time it holds your attention, or?
Yeah, so that is not explicit in the regulation. Okay. It says the company must articulate potential mental health risks and impacts on the youth user.
Okay.
And this is where it gets hard, because again, the camp scientifically is split. Some say it's not the amount of time per se, it is what you do in that time that you are on an app that is the variable. But then there are some who's like, well, it doesn't matter what you're doing. If you're going to be on it 8 hours of the day, it's still detrimental to your health. Mm-hmm. And so I say that's not in stone. So what a company is held against is those metrics. I think, at least in my read, are up to the company to determine. Partially because the science isn't there, but also like the government, for lack of better description, aren't well resourced into digging into those types of things. So they're kind of leaving that onus onto companies to articulate clearly. But there are also advocacy groups there that are pushing what those could be. So I think we'll see how those play out in a couple of years. But California just released theirs, I think, in fall of this year. And then we'll see how that will play out for companies.
Yeah, I used to represent a gummy bear company. The advertising guidelines are very established. You can't show more than like a serving size in a frame, and you can see how as things evolve and become more sophisticated that it makes sense to apply these types of laws to technology.
That's a great example, is kind of like can't do cigarettes directly
to kids.
So there should be guidelines like on the app side for the same.
Packaging for adult products can't appeal to kids in certain ways.
Exactly.
Well, you've mentioned there are mental health layers you're covering in the work that you do at Blue Fever. Can you fill us in on what's going on with kids right now based on the data you're seeing at work?
Yeah, I will say it's the data that we're seeing at work, but it's also pretty much affirmed by national surveys that the rate of loneliness and suicide amongst teens is rising. Interestingly enough, that was the case prior to COVID, exacerbated by COVID. And so I think the alarm bells of our teens not in a great state is very warranted to be ringing right now. What is causing those? Again, these are very, very difficult, intertwined causalities that I think is, there are high likely drivers that it's technology related. It's also environmentally related. It is also the current economic, political. So untangling all of those, it seems to be like a pursuit that would be really difficult, right? So what we can do is just knowing that there's likely an influence by technology, what can we do to understand that? One of the things that I think is really fascinating about the work that we've done and that, you know, really gives light to kind of the situation for youth, particularly for the ones on our platform at Blue Fever, is that there's this distrust, incredible distrust in traditional therapeutic avenues. Mm. They don't even trust therapists. There's a high distrust in school counselors. There's a high distrust in sharing with their parents. Not surprisingly, in some ways, there's a high level of trust amongst peers. They want to find support within peers, but that, as you can imagine, can only go so far depending on their journey. If you have someone who is in a very depressive state that could tip them to suicide, cohort support is not enough. But then you have to overcome this distrust of going towards therapy or going to a counselor. And I think I didn't understand the gravity of that until we started working with Blue Fear and we started digging into what the needs were. We recently ran something where we were essentially trying to understand from our community, do you seek therapy or is therapy something that you're interested in? And the results were, yes, I'm actually already in therapy, but it's not enough. And I'm looking for something else. Hmm. And the question is, well, why is it not enough? And what is that something else that you need? So those are the kinds of things that are surfacing right now. And it's intriguing that traditional support systems that you might think would be useful are not living up to what
they need
to be. Yeah.
How are you seeing these mental health challenges manifesting on various platforms?
Yeah. So specific to Blue Fever, you can think of ours as a journal, almost like a community journal. You can choose to express yourselves in text or through emojis or GIFs, publicly or personally. That's how it is. It's that expression. Mm-hmm. For other platforms, similarly, I think there's been work at Meta, there's work at TikTok of identifying expressions of self-harm, either just through text analysis, through image analysis, things like that. We know at least within the text realm, in the natural language realm, that we have some tooling to help us kind of identify this in the text expressions of youth. And for all of these platforms, there's backends that are attempting to find these and help up-level them in the moderation systems.
You're saying that on the back end, they're trying to mitigate it. How do they judge whether that's successful? Like, are they saying mental health is not as bad this quarter as it was last quarter? Or like, what does that even look like?
That's a great question. This is something that I think every company struggles with. There's actually, interestingly, a news article that was released last night on, I think it was Forbes, by Joel Rosenblatt, on the fact that Meta knew from internal conversations that there were mental health issues that were not being addressed. And they made decisions that were questionable about whether they were addressing those flags within their internal research team. There's a, can we detect it and flag it question? Then there is a, what do we do with that question? And then there's a, is that going to impact the business question?
Mm-hmm. Like, do we even want to know? Do we even want to dig into that? Exactly. Are we required to?
And so when that happens, that question about are people having better mental health or is mental health better? Yeah. It gets way more complicated than that, right? And so I do think it's hard when you know it's happening to figure out, well, what is the best course of action, given we are a business.
Right. As a public company, are they required to share that data? Okay, no. So they just choose not to say.
Yeah. I think there are efforts that they have publicly made to, again, this is for all of them, Meta, TikTok, right? Like where they are acknowledging that this is happening on the platforms and providing some level of resource. Maybe it is a mental health hub where people can find resources or connect with others. It's not that they don't realize it's there. It's those other two branches that what do we do with it and what does it do for the business, where it gets a little bit more complicated. And then you have to try to figure out whether you action on it or not. One thing that our founder always mentions when we talk about Blue Fever is that those platforms, social media in particular, were not built with mental health at the core. This is not a concern for them.
Right.
Whereas for us, we even position Blue Fever as a place where you can have your mental health journey authentically. Mm-hmm. And so our decisions when it comes to business and what we action on have to converge, mm-hmm. because that is the core. So I think what will end up happening, and you kind of see this already, is that people will start moving to those types of places where they know will service whatever they're trying to get at. And so maybe social media isn't that space. So find a space that will. That's, I think, what you'll start seeing more of. And we see that with like Headspace and all those other platforms that are starting to pop up.
Right.
Yeah. We had worked with client doing something similar in the past. And he described it as like, you know, when you need a brain break and like you think to go to social media, whether or not that's actually a brain break, mm-hmm. maybe you can open an app that is more of a positive experience exactly. for your brain and access positive resources. Because our brains are hardwired at this point to scroll,
yeah.
can you do that same behavior in a healthier environment?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I hope people learn. That they can't. Like the options are limitless right now. You don't always have to just be on TikTok or Facebook. There are other places that can support you for those kinds of things.
I feel like Pinterest is that for me. Like I feel like Pinterest is one of those more like positive scrolling feeds because you build it yourself. So it's interesting to think about, especially like I think of TikTok and Instagram where you can just scroll forever, but there's no like Netflix pop-up that's like, are you still watching this? Or like it should be like a pop-up that comes up that's like, is this what's best for right. your mental health at this right. moment?
Shame.
Right. Yeah.
yeah. Shame. And maybe it's like, as women, I think we are given more mental health resources. Like, I feel like it's ingrained in a lot of the content I absorb mm-hmm. and listen to. Like, I'm very grateful for like a lot of the podcasters I follow. And so a lot of them will often advertise like BetterHelp. So yeah. can you explain a little bit about how AI is integrated into those apps and what your opinion is on it? And then also for Blue Fever, if you guys use those capabilities as well.
So I think for those without knowing their system really intimately, mm-hmm. I think the easiest way to think about this is as a recommendation. Essentially do all the calculations of what kind of therapy are you looking for? What's the best fit? And on the back end, that is, okay, let's take all of these signals, figure out who we can recommend out of the list of therapists that we have. Mm-hmm. For this person, like this is the matching problem, right? Like, can we match mm-hmm. the user with the correct resource? And so again, sort of a weak AI in some senses. There have been of late some examples of which companies have tried using ChatGPT to do mental health chatting. Mm-hmm. Some have failed on the diagnosis. ChatGPT should not be diagnosing you.
No, that's dangerous.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But you know, people are thinking that could be a use case. So there is that level too that people are experimenting on. But for the most part, it is how can we match you with the right fit of a therapy? In some ways, we use similar things in terms of can we surface the right resource for you if you are in what part of your journey you're in. So that's also, again, a recommendation system in some ways, a very general way to think about it. And then there's also on the content moderation side, because we're a positive community, we have to figure out how to keep like the toxic things that might be toxic low. So we have to use machine learning algorithms to figure out those types of content. So there's, I will say most companies have some light form of machine learning happening on the back end to either help with recommendation or content moderation.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Before we go to the last question, is there anything we didn't cover that feels like really important to cover?
If I were to give like one message that putting together both this idea of generative AI and maybe mental health together, because I think that's a really interesting space, is we're not quite there yet in terms of using any of these technologies, even generative AI, to give a full idea of someone's mental health journey. I think that still requires very heavily the partnership of a human and yourself, or your partnership of your child and a human. I think the tools that are offered by BetterHelp, by using generative AI, is great because you can, as we all said earlier, have a first draft at what you're experiencing.
Right.
But it's not ready yet to be diagnosing, to be making critical decisions on your behalf. And mental health to me, I think, is really interesting. Like when we talk about privacy, we think about identifiers like your name or your phone number or your location. But mental health is a really, really intimate feeling, expression, identity. And I think in some ways that should be held closely to the vest when you think about how you do your interactions with any of these companies or platforms. Mm.
Keeping your data private.
Yeah, it's private, but it's also like sharing it responsibly, right? Like you're same with your PII, your private information. Share it responsibly, because the rollover effects is that you might have a decision made on behalf of that. You might have a recommendation made on behalf of that. And I just think be knowledgeable that that could be the case when you share that type of information.
It's like AI or ChatGPT is like, they're like our intern or our child.
Use them for
first drafts and for ideas, but not as...
Exactly. That's
our
a great
guide,
way.
Not as our guide.
Yeah. I love that. That's a great way to put it. I have yet to read a ChatGPT literary novel that I would be like, yes, you know, I would read pages of this. Most of the time I read four paragraphs and go, I cannot read more than this.
Yeah, for sure.
Right. It's a good collaborator.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, Christine, our last question for you today. What tool or service do you use to make life a little easier?
Yeah, this is a great question. I thought about it and I will say Libby. I don't know if you guys use Libby.
No, explain.
Yeah, Libby is for libraries. It can access your library through Libby. It's like it used to be OverDrive was what most libraries use. And you can have access to all books, to all magazines through it. And you can just read it on your Kindle or your iPad or whatever. I think the reason I say it's utilitarian and makes my life easier is because it allows me to totally disconnect in a different way. If I want to pick up that book, I can just switch to Libby as the app and then dig into something of another world that I want to. I think that's really useful. I think that helps you move between certain tasks without having to find your book that's placed somewhere else. You know, I can just switch to a different on my phone and dig into a story or something, even if I have 5 minutes, right? So
cool. Yeah. Is it good for kids too?
Yeah. It's great for kids. Yeah. So you can find, if your library system is connected to it, you should be able to access anything that you would at a normal library on Libby.
Cool. Libby, L-I-B-B-Y?
Yep. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Yeah. For being here.
Absolutely.
Christine, where can listeners find you?
I am mostly on LinkedIn, I guess, is the one place that you can connect with me, but you can always shoot me an email, christine.gloria@bluefever.com. Happy to answer questions there too.
Cool.
Awesome. Thank you so
much. Yeah, it was so fun to see you all again.
It was really fun.
You too.
Me sure. I was thinking this was the way to go, and you put up your puppet show. I say cheers to life. No, I'll be no good man. Why? Just give me a look.